Good Monday evening.
My Bible is open to John chapter 4. I encourage you to do the same. Before we begin, we have to make a secret pact. I forgot the shirt and tie that's supposed to match this suit. I don't know if this one does or not. If it does not, you are not allowed to tell my wife. That includes any social networking. That's a pact. I appreciate the lunch today with Skip and Linda, and I'll be tasting that meatloaf for a long time in a good way in my memory. And it was nice to refresh our friendship and learn what's going on in their lives. And I really miss you corporately as a Christian group here, and individually the people who are here. It whetted my appetite for my relationships with the people here at St. Clairsville. And I appreciate each of you, each family, and your presence here tonight. I do also want to thank my father-in-law, Emmanuel, and mother-in-law, Judy, for their hospitality and letting me stay at their home. I guess they have to. They don't have a choice. But I appreciate their generosity. They are such a support to me, and I love them very much. In John chapter 4, Jesus has this encounter with a woman by a well. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat by the well. It was about the sixth hour, that's noon. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Then the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." Soon after, my brother married his wife. My brother Shane married Joy. Joy wanted to surprise him with one of his favorite meals, tuna noodle casserole. So she looked up a recipe. She cut out the noodles. She made the special sauce, the little crumbly topping, baked it in the oven. And that night when he ate it, he didn't like it. It upset her. She called my mom. "How do you make your tuna noodle casserole?" She said, "Just get a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese, a can of Campbell's cream of chicken soup," he doesn't like cream of mushroom, "and a can of tuna. Throw it in a pot on the stove." My brother had developed an appetite for an inferior version of tuna noodle casserole, and he didn't appreciate the better one. And I wonder sometimes if that also happens to us religiously. That we as churchgoers, Sunday after Sunday, if we're not careful, can tend to settle back into an inferior version of what it means to follow Jesus Christ between Sundays and fail to appreciate the real life that is offered in Christ. And maybe one of the reasons why we are supposed to get together in times like this is to reset our expectations and to acknowledge the high standard and to hear again the life that's offered in Jesus Christ. And this encounter this evening between Jesus and this woman can help us answer this question for our life right now. That is, how alive are you? So I want us to go and look at this story. Jesus, of course, is sitting by a well, and this woman from Samaria comes. It is 12 o'clock noon, and 12 o'clock noon is not a good time to go to the well because the sun is hot, the walk is long, the pot is heavy. But later in the story, we learn what kind of woman she is, which maybe tells us why she went to the well alone and didn't socialize with the other ladies, she would not have been voted president of the local women's club. Jesus says, "Give me a drink." And the woman reacts. We don't hear the tone in her voice, but she is startled. "How is it that you, being a Jew, asked me, a Samaritan, for a drink?" How did she know that Jesus wasn't one of her tribe? Was it his appearance in some way, his manner, his dialect, his accent? Some way she knew, "You're not one of my tribe. You're a Jew. I am a Samaritan." And that word Samaritan, which John informs us, Jews have no dealings with them, it was back then a charged word. You know, like when you're walking out in the woods and you come across an electric fence and you wonder, is it loaded? Is it charged? And you have to find someone brave enough to touch it to see if it's charged. Well, this word Samaritan is a charged ethnic racial word, much like maybe Republican, Democrat, liberal is today politically. And Jesus didn't care, though. He ignored this social, religious, ethnic, racial boundary, and he crossed right over it in this discussion with this woman. In fact, Jesus says, "Well, if you knew who you were talking to, you would have asked me, and I would give you water." And the woman replies, confused, "How can you give me water? Because you don't have a jar or a bucket to get it." But she's curious and says, "Are you greater than our father Jacob?" The woman then affirms her own status before God and defends, in essence, her heritage when she says to him regarding our father Jacob, "He gave us this well, drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock." Verse 12. "You don't have any advantage on me," perhaps she is suggesting. "I too have heritage with God, even though you, a Jew, look down your nose at me, a Samaritan." And Jesus says, "Whoever drinks of the water I give them will never thirst." Whether the woman believed him or not, either seriously or sarcastically, she says, "Sir, give me this water." Now, at this point in their conversation, Jesus decides that the time for small talk is over. And Jesus says, "Go call your husband and come here." And the woman says, briefly, "I have no husband." And Jesus says, "You're right. You've had five husbands. And the man you're living with now won't even marry you." And she changes the subject. We tend to do that sometimes when we're not comfortable in social discourse. And if you change the subject to religion, which is what she did, then you really don't want to talk about what you've been talking about. So she changes the subject to religion, and she talks about herself and her people, the Samaritans. "I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped here." Jesus talks to her about worship. The woman, perhaps wanting to end the conversation, says, "Well, but when the Christ comes, he will tell us all things." And right there, by that well, Jesus makes a self-revelation. And he says to the woman, "I who speak to you am. I am the Christ." She drops her water pot. She runs to the city. She gathers people, calls them out. They return to the well. And the text reads that many of the Samaritans believed. What was the message that the woman carried? What was the message that the woman took to the city from her encounter with Jesus at the well? It's one line that's used twice to summarize what she said. It is this: "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Come see a man who told me everything I ever did." She says it twice. She says it in verse number 39 And she says it in verse number 29. Come, see a man who sees me. What is attractive about that? What was it about that line, that notion, that message that brought the crowd out? Well, to try to clarify, I want to take you to another woman by the well. The other woman at the well in the Old Testament. And we have to climb all the way back to Genesis chapter 19 to find this woman at the well. The main character in this part of the story in the Bible is Abraham and his wife Sarah. Abraham is a nomad from the east. And nomads typically do not migrate. They do not travel. But God made Abraham a big promise. In fact, the promise that God made Abraham, which is recorded in Genesis 12, 1 through 3, is so big, so massive, so heavy, that the entire Old Testament revolves around it. God promised Abraham blessing, land, descendants, and that all nations of the earth would find favor through his people. But God called Abraham to migrate, to move, and to wander in the land of Canaan. And so Abraham wandered for 10 years in the land of Canaan. Now, this promise that God made Abraham was for Abraham's descendants, his children. And here we see a problem, because Abraham is 85 and Sarah is 76, and they do not have children. If they could have by then, they would have. They do not. There was no OBGYN, no testing, no technology. The only thing they knew is that Sarah cannot have children. This is problematic. You see, if God's promise to Abraham is dependent upon Abraham having children, but Abraham can't have any children, how is God going to keep his promise? And so for 10 years they wander. 10 years after the original promise, they wait. 10 years of candlelight dinners in the tent on Saturday night, and still no child. And then Sarah has an idea. Sarah has a handmaid named Hagar. And Sarah tells Abraham, please, go into my maid. Perhaps I should obtain children by her. Now, we don't understand that. Yeah, that sounds bizarre. But contextually, it is less bizarre than we think it is, as Americans in 2014. Take my handmaid, marry her, I'll have a child through her, and maybe that is how God will keep his promise, since I can't have any children. And Abraham listened. Was there a formal ceremony to mark the union? We cannot know. But you know, sometimes you can smell trouble coming, you can see that something's going to be a problem a mile away, and that's the case here. You don't have to be a Bible genius to know this is not going to work out. Because after the marriage, Hagar does have a son. And as soon as Hagar has a son, her attitude towards Sarah changes. You see, in the ancient Near East, they didn't know what we know. And there was a stigma attached to a woman who could not bear children. Now we know there's something wrong biologically. Then they thought there was something wrong spiritually with the woman. Her attitude towards Sarah changes, and Sarah picks up on it, and she goes right to Abraham, and she confronts Abraham. Now, us husbands are saying, why are you confronting him? He didn't do anything. Well, exactly. He didn't do anything. He should have stepped forward and been the spiritual leader, but he did not. And Abraham essentially says, well, Hagar is your handmaid. She's with child, but you do with her what you want. And Sarah did whatever she did, however she wanted. and Hagar runs away. Hagar leaves, and she finally drops by a well in the wilderness. And while Hagar is there at the well in the wilderness, God comes to her and says, "Hagar, where are you going?" She says, My master is upset with me. I can't go back." And the angel of the Lord, God, tells her, "Return. Go back to her. Submit to her. God is with you." And she receives a special promise for her boy from God. Now, what does Hagar think of this encounter? We know what she thinks, because Hagar renames God. Do you know what she calls him? She calls him, in the text, El Roy. He sees me. He sees me. And she said when she left, "Have I seen the one who sees me?" Can I suggest to you that until that point, no one had seen her. There she was by the well, scared, hungry, homeless. An Egyptian slave girl bought or caught by a Mesopotamian clan. She attached herself to them just out of survival, doing what she had to of necessity just to live. And her master convinces her to have a child with her husband and then is angry with her, so she leaves. And there Hagar is, by the well. She's afraid. She is hungry. She is homeless. Where is she going to go? What is she going to do? Who can help her? She is alone. Her family may as well be on the other side of the planet. She has no friends. She has no body. She's alone. She is disposable. She was used like an appliance. She didn't have to be who she was to do what she did. She is a throwaway. She's litter. She's disposable. And she's invisible. Nobody asks her what she wants. Nobody cares how she feels. Nobody really knows who she is. Can anybody see her? Does anybody see her? Yes. There is one who sees her. God. Are you surprised? Are you surprised that the one who can see all the stars notices Hagar? Surprised that the one who at the time is engineering a cosmic plot to save all mankind stoops to help a slave girl caught in a domestic mess? Are you surprised that the one bothered by all of our prayers bothers with this pregnant runaway? Are you surprised? Well, if you are, then maybe your God is too big. How big is God? You know, during Vacation Bible School, our kids sing that song, "My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do." We don't have to be sold theologically on the notion that God is big. We get that. In 1999, the Hubble telescope found 125 billion, not million, billion galaxies, not planets, galaxies in our universe. By 2002, that number climbed to 300 billion galaxies in our universe, which makes me wonder, why in the world would God make a place so big except for God to be able to say, "I am this big"? But the problem with that is, when you buy into the notion that God is that big,
if he's even the size of Jupiter, it's kind of hard for him to get through my front door. When I was a boy growing up, going to church at the Piketon Church of Christ on the hill in Pike County, I thought our auditorium, I thought it was huge. I grew up, left, went away to college, and I can remember coming home from college one time and standing in our auditorium and thinking, wow, this place is small. Now, did the auditorium shrink? No. My world just got bigger. Because size is relative. How big is the state of Ohio compared to what? Is your daughter tall compared to who? Size is relative. So talking about God and size, it doesn't fit. It's kind of like asking, what does Beethoven's Fifth Symphony smell like? You can't measure it the same. In fact, someone would say, well, look, God is spiritual, and you can't talk about physical dimensions when it comes to God. And you are right, which means that we accept the limitations of our language, and we believe a contradiction. That God is very big, but God also is very small. He is bigger than outer space. He is small enough to fit in my space. That is the plaintive cry of Hagar. Do you hear her? He sees me. I'm just an Egyptian slave girl. I'm afraid. I'm alone. I'm disposable. I'm invisible. But God sees me. It's the plaintive cry of Hagar. It's really the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. The doctrine of the smallness of God finds its animation in Jesus Christ who came. And I would suggest to you that that is the angle that the Samaritan woman by the well saw. What did she say again? He told me everything I ever did. He knows everything about me. He sees me. He sees me. We like to be seen. I miss this. Watch me, Daddy. My girls are 22 and 20. They text me for money. But they don't say, watch me, Daddy. I miss that. We like to be noticed when we walk into the room. Now, we don't want everyone to stop and applaud, but we like someone to notice when we walk into the room. That's all part of the attraction of Facebook, Twitter, the social networking is we get to be seen, known, noticed. You can find people that you graduated from high school with, and man, they look old and squishy, but you find them and you are allowed to see their life now and let them see. We like to be seen. We like to be noticed. Or do we? Do we really? You know, you can't believe everything that you read on a Facebook profile because we don't always... You know, my daughter has an app on her phone that will Photoshop a picture. And I watched her do it last Tuesday, a week ago, at the play-in games in Dayton. She took a picture of us together, and she Photoshopped me, and I looked better. My teeth were whiter when she was done with it. You suppose all the photos on Facebook are Photoshopped? We pose, don't we? Even us guys, I've done this before. I've been in a circle of men, and they're talking about maybe They're talking about repairing a car and something they had to do with some part. And I kind of nodded my head as if I knew what they were talking about and I didn't have a clue. But you see, us men, we won't drop our guard for nothing. We won't. So we have this tension, you see. I want to be seen, but I don't really want to be seen. I want you to know me, but I don't want you to really know me. Because there's risk. Because I've tried that before. And it's dangerous for you to really see all of me. In fact, I'm afraid that if you really saw me, you wouldn't like me. But God, do you hear? He sees me. He knows all about me. He told me everything I ever did. Is that appealing? She ran to the city and said, "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did." I would have ran and hid. I don't want to know that guy. I don't want him to see me. I don't want him to tell me everything I've ever done. Five men had gotten to know the Samaritan woman. And all five left. Jesus knew everything about her and stayed. Can I translate what he told her? He said, "Go call your husband and come here." Can I translate that? Jesus says, "I know you. I see you. Don't pose. Don't pretend. Don't put on. I see everything you've ever done. I knew everything about you. And I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying right here." How attractive is that? What would it be like to be in a relationship without a mask? What if you could be real? What if someone knew everything about you and loved you anyway? What if someone saw everything you've ever done and stayed? What if you were in a relationship where you never wanted to pose your false self, but you always only wanted to be you? That is our relationship with God and Jesus Christ. He sees me. Which brings up our question, how alive are you? You know, there are different ways to measure. I can tell you that from the grocery store to my house, it's 2.6 miles. Or I can tell you it's the length of Taylor Swift's song, "You Belong to Me." Or I can tell you that it's the time it takes for me to eat a giant Chico stick and get it down and pick all the candy out of my teeth before I get in and anyone notices. We have different ways to measure. How are you measuring life? How do we measure life? How alive are you? How do we measure how alive we are? Salary? Is it just raw numbers? Whoever makes the most is the most alive. Is it money? Stuff? What kind of car you drive? Your occupation? What restaurant you can eat in? How do we measure life? Can I suggest that a primary way to measure, to answer this question, how alive are you? Can I suggest that a primary way is your relationships? because you know as well as I do, you've heard this preached before, or you've seen it in some plaque at a Christian bookstore. In the end, it doesn't matter how much money you made. Whether your face was on the cover of Time magazine, what matters in the end is people. It's the people in your life. It is your relationships. You can measure your life by the depth of your relationships. And it begins with God. How alive are you? Well, not very if you can't be you. But with God, you don't have a choice. You have to be you. Because guess what? He sees me. And He sees you. And it is this to the bone, unflinching intimacy that we have with God that is so attractive. Because God says, I know where you've been. I know what you've done. I know who you are. I see everything about you. And I'm not going anywhere. And there's nothing you can do to make me love you more. How's that for an appeal? How's that for a call, an invitation? How's that for an offer? God extends it to us in Jesus Christ. How alive are you? As we sing this song, I want you to think about that answer in terms of your relationships. Specifically, the depth of your relationships. Don't say, hey, I got 1,500 friends on Facebook. I'm doing good. I don't mean the number, necessarily, of your relationships. I mean the depth of your relationships. Those to-the-bone, unflinching, intimate-level relationships that give us true fulfillment, true gratification, true joy. If you're here and you're not a Christian and maybe you've never begun your walk with the Lord, you've never responded to the gospel, Jesus dying on the cross for you, and if you're not sure what God expects of you, or if you would like to talk more about the invitation of God to begin your Christian walk, if that's not something you can ever say, yes, I've done that, then someone here would be happy to study the Bible with you. Maybe you're here tonight and you know what God expects. And if you're ready to confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, just as He claimed to be, and if you're ready to turn to the Lord, begin following Him, repent, turn away from where you're going, and follow the Lord, and share in His dying and rising in baptism, we can put you under the water and pull you back up, and you can be born again of water and the Spirit, and you can begin your walk with the Lord. If you're here maybe as a Christian, and maybe there's something in this text, something in this notion with Hagar and the Samaritan woman that has corrected you, maybe you felt the leverage, and maybe you need prayers for some reason for your walk with the Lord, then we want to encourage you also to come. We'd be happy to pray on your behalf. If you have a need, please come while we stand and sing.